the big mistake in this pattern of failure is projecting your subjective lack of comprehension onto the object you're looking at as irrationality. We make this mistake because we are tempted by a desire for legibility. And just as an aside, I think the author's talking about left brain's penchant for ruley, controllable systems that it can understand and logically analyze. Compare and contrast the right brain's larger picture instinct, its love of the living, of the spontaneous, and the fact that it doesn't stress about systems which are beyond its control. I'm recalling Tony Wright's suggestion that the left brain dominance over the right brain dominance is an ongoing disease of Homo sapiens, so-called. Legibility and control. Central to Scott's thesis is the idea of legibility. He explains how he stumbled across the idea while researching efforts by nation-states to settle or sedentarize nomads, pastoralists, gypsies, and other people living non-mainstream lives. Quote, "The more I examined these efforts at sedentarization, the more I came to see them as a state's attempt to make society legible, to arrange the population in ways that simplified the classic state functions of taxation, conscription, and the prevention of rebellion. Having begun to think in these terms, I began to see legibility as a central problem in statecraft. The pre-modern state was, in many crucial respects, particularly blind. It knew precious little about its subjects, their wealth, their landholdings, their yields, their location, their very identity. It lacked anything like a detailed map of its terrain and its people." Unquote. The book begins with an early example, scientific forestry. The early modern state, Germany in this case, was only interested in maximizing tax revenues from forestry. This meant that the acreage, yield, and market value of a forest had to be measured, and only these obviously relevant variables were comprehended by the statist mental model. Traditional wild and unruly forests were literally illegible to the state surveyor's eyes, and this gave birth to scientific forestry. The gradual transformation of forests, with a rich diversity of species growing wildly and randomly, into orderly stands of the highest yielding varieties. The resulting catastrophes, better recognized these days as the problems of monoculture, were inevitable. The picture is not an exception, and the word legibility is not a metaphor. The actual visual, textual sense of the word, as in readability, is what is meant. The book is full of thought-provoking pictures like this. Farmland neatly divided up into squares versus farmland that is confusing to the eye, but conforms to the constraints of local topography, soil quality, and hydrological patterns. Rational and unlivable grid cities like Brasilia versus chaotic and alive cities like Sao Paulo. High modernist, think Bauhaus and Le Corbusier, aesthetics necessarily lead to simplification. Since a reality that serves many purposes presents itself as illegible to a vision informed by a singular purpose, any elements that are non-functional with respect to the singular purpose tend to confuse and are therefore eliminated during the attempt to rationalize. The deep failure in thinking lies in the mistaken assumption that thriving, successful, and functional realities must necessarily be legible, or at least more legible to the all-seeing statist eye in the sky than to the local embedded eye on the ground. Complex realities turn this logic on its head. It's easier to comprehend the whole by walking among the trees, absorbing the gestalt, becoming a holographic, fractal part of the forest, than by hovering above it. This imposed simplification in service of legibility to the state's eye makes the rich reality brittle, and failure follows. The imagined improvements are not realized. The metaphors of killing the golden goose and the Procrustean bed come to mind.
Stop the takeover of nature by financial markets. While people are concerned with the harsh austerity measures implemented in many European countries as a consequence of the financial crisis, financial actors are working almost unnoticed towards the submission of nature under their logic. We live in a so-called financialized economy, an economy dominated by finance and financial actors which focus on creating new investment and profit opportunities. The key to do it was the creation of a single global capital market through the abolition of control of movements of capitals by governments, the deregulation of large sectors of the economy, as well as the withdrawal of the state and providing essential services to citizens. Trading money, risk and associated products has become more profitable and outpaces trading goods and services for capital accumulation. This has huge implications over the daily exposure of people to financial markets in aspects which go from home ownership to pensions and schooling. In this financialization process, financial markets and its institutions take control over the productive economy where goods and services are produced, and corporations, households and banks are transformed to abide by the logic of financial markets by speculating or getting indebted. Instead of financial markets providing money to produce what people need, money is increasingly invested into financial markets to operate and expand. It literally turns the world upside down. Now, the housing bubble has burst, and the huge sums of money in financial markets are now seeking new investment opportunities, and this is where nature comes into the picture. About making profits with nature, we know already the role of financial players investing in mines, oil fields or agricultural activities, or purchasing cargoes of raw materials by playing on price trends or derivative markets. But the financialization of nature currently at work is a much deeper process. Back in 2005, the EU introduced the so-called Emission Trading Scheme, ETS, with the argument to reduce carbon emissions. In this scheme, companies are given a maximum of rights in the form of emission certificates to pollute the air with CO2. As the certificates can be traded between companies, financial markets were created and CO2 made a financial asset. This has created a profit opportunity for many companies and financial actors buying and selling emission certificates. EU economies continue to produce in an unsustainable and polluting way above the limits that the planet can support, rather than reducing their own emissions. The same proposals are being made for forests, biodiversity, or ecosystems, and all the ecological functions that could provide a service to humanity. To submit nature under the logic of financial markets requires to define what nature does as environmental service. So the tree's capacity to capture carbon, the decomposition of waste, water purification, and regulation of the climate is now defined, normalized, quantified, and certified as an environmental service. Once this is done, you can start placing a price tag to each service, evaluate their current status, state a limit, and concretize in economic terms the cost of their conservation in order to develop a market for each particular environmental service. So nature as such becomes a company, and for this, the green economy and market-based instruments are powerful tools for managing the economic invisibility of nature. With new property rights, a new phase of enclosures and extraction of natural resources and biodiversity, grabbing is taking place. So people are kicked off their lands, communities and nature are destroyed, and the global south becomes the loser. All those engaged in this green economy and financial markets become the winners. This green economy is no solution to any of the problems and crises we are facing today. Whether it is to deal with climate change, to maintain biodiversity and ecosystems, or to offer a solution to unemployment and unequal distribution of goods and wealth. There are many alternatives to solve these problems which are outside of the logic of financial markets. We must not privatize nature, submitting it to the profit interests of financial markets. We must defend and reclaim old and create new commons by excluding markets and financial markets from their management and control. This also includes the various public goods and services. We must change the way we produce and consume, orienting our economies towards real needs we have and towards more localized economies. We must promote a model of production and distribution of food based on food sovereignty, as well as decentralized and democratically controlled production of clean energies. We must shrink the financial sector, regulate it, and get it under democratic and public control to make sure it is functional to real needs and the public good. Get engaged in fighting against financial markets taking over the control of nature and in the promotion of real alternatives.
And to conclude the show, another interview from Against the Grain. This is from earlier this month.
You can say that the financial sector has grown more powerful and influential in recent years, but you wouldn't be saying anything new or surprising. Max Haven goes further than that by arguing in a new book that a process called financialization is seeping into everyday life, is affecting to a large and disturbing degree our conceptions of ourselves, our priorities, personal and professional, and our sense, our imagination of the future. Finance capital and its associated logics, Haven contends, are also transforming the way corporations behave and governments operate. Max Haven is assistant professor of art, history, and critical studies at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, and he's been involved in student peace, trade union, anti-racist, and indigenous solidarity struggles. His written work has appeared in Truthout, Znet, Social Text, and other publications, and his book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, Capitalism, Creativity, and the Commons, is just out from Zed Books. When Max Haven joined me with the technical assistance of Pierre Loisel from Halifax, Nova Scotia, I began by asking Max about what the financial sector is and what it consists of.
The financial sector is usually referred to in the literature as the FIRE sector, which stands for finance, insurance, and real estate. By finance here, we're talking about sort of high finance, the operations of major investment and commercial banks, the ways in which money moves around the globe. Insurance is a huge industry which encompasses not only the sort of auto insurance or home insurance that most of us are familiar with, but also huge forms of corporate insurance, government insurance, reinsurance, that is, insurers who insure other insurers. And of course, real estate, you know, which we know about quite intimately, most of us, in one way or another, whether we're owners or renters or what have you. But of course, real estate also includes land, it includes agricultural land, and it includes rental properties, it includes land speculation. So really, the financial sector or the FIRE sector is this quite a sprawling set of concerns. All of them, though, are interested in or concerned with the speculative nature of wealth. This is not an industry that creates, for the most part, it doesn't create, you know, real hard and fast assets. It doesn't create things. Rather, it commodifies the future. It transforms risk of future eventualities into something that can be bought and sold now. Finance is essentially the capitalist means by which the future can be tamed, by which tomorrow can be brought into the present and managed. If you consider the way that capitalism works as this sort of ever-expanding system of accumulation, that expansion depends on people being willing, wealthy people and capitalists being able to lend money to one another in order that they can create new ventures, create new factories, commodify more aspects of social life. And so the speculative aspect here basically allows for the risk of future profitable enterprises to be spread out amongst multiple investors. So speculation is extremely central to the way that finance and the financial economy works.
And before we go further, how big is the financial sector? How large a portion of the economy, let's say in the U.S., is it?
There are various estimates, and it depends how you crunch the numbers. But certainly over the last 30 years, the financial sector has been the fastest growing industry, so-called, in the United States. Just one sort of shocking figure is that around the time of the 2008 crash, simply the value of one financial product, over-the-counter derivative product, was estimated at being worth somewhere in the range of $600 trillion of outstanding contracts. And just to put that in context, the world GDP is only about $60 trillion. So you get the sense that the financial economy is mammoth in its control over money and wealth.
Many observers are fond of distinguishing between the financial sector and the, quote, real economy. What do you think of that distinction?
There's certainly a certain merit to it in the sense that most of what goes on in the financial sector, if we imagine the world of investment banks, of hedge funds, of sovereign wealth funds, these have very little to do, at least on the surface, with the nuts and bolts of an actual economy, of people going, you know, waking up and going to work every day on public transit, of people working in fields, of people working in factories. But in fact, holding the two separately is quite dangerous, because one of the lessons that we can learn from a history of finance is that it's never been separate from the underlying capitalist reality. In fact, finance has always served a role at propping up, at financing, at helping to protect and enlarge the capitalist economy. And it has a very strong disciplinary role on all those other aspects of the so-called real economy that we're familiar with. For instance, most corporations today are really under the thumb of the financial sector, in the sense that companies today are increasingly forced to cut back on expenses like wages and benefits in order to please the ever higher demands for returns on investment by investors. Governments, which still employ a huge number of people, are constantly under the thumb of the financial sector, demanding that they cut back expenses and approach their operations more like a business, in order that they'll be able to borrow more money through government bonds and such. So in reality, it's very easy to say, oh, we want to return to a real economy instead of this highly financialized one. But we may need to take another look at that, because the two have never been as cleanly separated as we might imagine.
So are we getting here into your argument in this book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, that the financial sector or the logic of finance has seeped into other arenas?
Yes, precisely. And you know, this process has been going on for quite a long time, but we've really seen the dramatic expansion of this process of financialization over the last 40 years, the period of time that we associate with globalization, with neoliberalism. And my argument here is that, you know, it's easy to imagine that financialization is just this economic process where we see the massive growth of the financial sector on the one hand, and the incredible power of finance over companies, over governments on the other. But it's also other things too. So financialization is a political process where increasingly governments see themselves as really at the beck and call of the financial sector, in the sense that they need to borrow money, they need to run large deficits in order to operate. And this gives the financial sector incredible control over politics and policy in really unprecedented ways. Ways that, for instance, in the last few years have seen practically none of the financial elites be charged or sentenced for any of the debauchery that occurred leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. In ways, too, that see governments increasingly turn to the financial sector for answers to problems they might have once attempted to solve themselves. For instance, we've seen over the last couple of years the rise of social impact bonds and social impact investing, which basically sees governments contract out poverty alleviation, attempts to lower recidivism rates for youth crime, essentially to private financial companies, which then, you know, through special arrangements, take a crack at solving these public problems. So we've seen, you know, financialization economically, we see it politically. And my argument is we also begin to see it sociologically and culturally as well.
Well, couldn't one say, and you know, the argument's been made on this program, I think many times over the years, that it's not so much financialization, but the neoliberal regime that is, for example, turning public institutions and public agencies to private concerns for the delivery of public services, which I guess then, in a sense, turn into private services. How then is neoliberalism and financialization in your mind either intertwined or distinct?
I think they're intimately intertwined. Neoliberalism names the sort of ideological veneer on a deeper process of financialization. And of course, both are facets or historical formations of an underlying system of capitalist accumulation. I think that financialization is both the cause and the consequence in some ways of neoliberalism. It's the cause of it in the sense that in the last 40 years, we've seen this massive pressure on governments, on policymakers, even on companies to increasingly see themselves as vehicles for investment. So we've seen universities transformed from a public good to some individualized consumer product where one is supposed to invest in one's future by, you know, essentially purchasing a degree. Or we've seen government policy increasingly see itself not as taking care of the public in any way, but as making certain targeted investments. And in this sense, the capacity of governments to care for populations, as problematic as that once was in the sort of Keynesian welfare state, has been replaced by this much more financialized idea of what government is for. And I think that is what has driven neoliberalism in a certain sense. The ideological ideas about the retreat of government, the privatization of services, the liberalization of trade, these are all in some ways responses to financialization. But of course, they aid and abet the further financialization of the economy.
Let me ask you a little bit more about how financial logic, financialization has seeped into the way corporations operate, corporations that we might not place within the category of the financial sector. You write that perhaps the most egregious example of companies that have been overtaken by this logic are private equity firms like Bain Capital, which many people will remember as the firm co-founded by Mitt Romney. So what do corporations like this exist to do, and why are they, in a sense, your poster child for the financialized corporation?
Yeah, well, these companies have an incredible amount of power, and private equity firms like Bain Capital essentially are clubs of some of the richest and most powerful people and institutions in the American economy today. And essentially, they exist to buy up troubled companies or companies that are otherwise having difficulty and liquidate them. They're effectively trying to create a fire sale condition, or they try and restructure those companies brutally by firing workers, by selling off whole portions of the company in order to get a return on their investment. They buy the company when it's troubled at a low price. They try and turn it around, sell off what assets it has, restructure it, and sell it back on the markets for a higher price. And of course, the people who lose out on this are primarily the workers, many of whom are laid off or fired. Often these companies will demand that pension funds be gutted or that union won contracts be rolled back. They'll often fire huge portions of the workforce and contract out those jobs at the other end.
Let's say I buy a stock in a corporation and I'm told, as we are told, that the stock represents a share of ownership in that corporation. Well, that seems to tie the stock to a real world value, right? To wealth as it exists in the real economy, as opposed to some imaginary wealth or virtual wealth that we might put in the category of the financial economy. Is that a correct way to look at it?
I argue no. It's a tempting way to look at it, and it's the way that certainly financial insiders, people on Wall Street, would like us to imagine how finance works. You know, if you speak to many of the traders and defenders of the sector, they'll say that really this is a way for companies to raise money. You know, they go out and they sell shares. Shares represent a portion of ownership in a company. If you as a little investor give a little money to them, you will have a part ownership, and then you'll be entitled to a share of the profits. And allegedly, the cost of a share or a bond is going to be a reflection of that productive capacity of whatever company you bought into. But of course, we know very well that that's not the case, that in fact, many, many people and many, many institutions are buying stocks and shares, not because they want a piece of ownership of an underlying asset, but because they're speculating on what they might be able to sell it for a week from now, a month from now, a year from now. And in fact, the whole economy is so driven by this speculative ethos that we lose track of what those real values were supposed to be underneath. And I'll give you a relatively concrete and quite horrific example. The vast majority of the world's grain, of its soybeans, of its petroleum, of its coffee beans are actually bought and sold multiple times before the crops are even harvested and before the resources are even extracted, because they're traded through futures contracts and through other derivative financial products well in advance of them actually being harvested and shipped. Nominally, at least in an ideal world, this would help both buyers and sellers hedge against future price fluctuations. So if you're a grocery store and you're going to buy several tons of bananas each year, it makes sense to lock in the price of bananas now and buy them in a year's time so that you won't be surprised if there's a drought, say, in Honduras, which, you know, destroys its productive capacity for bananas. But of course, what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years is that these contracts, which say, I will buy or sell this commodity at some point in the future, have become freely tradable and the objects of great and intensive speculation. And this is what is happening in the financialized economy more and more, not only for futures contracts on what are called commodities, that is, you know, coffee, bananas, wheat, petroleum, what have you. It's also happening, as we saw in 2008, to mortgages. It's happening to student loans. It's happening to medical debt. It's happening to almost every aspect of the economy. And so what we see is this increasing divide between what we imagine to be the real value of things and the prices at which they circulate on speculative markets. And that's wreaking absolute havoc. So for instance, in the wake of the 2008 crisis, we saw massive speculation in commodities futures, in grain prices, which drove up the price of rice, the price of wheat, the price of corn, and other staple crops, so much so that they were out of reach of many of the world's poorest people. This was happening at exactly the same time that the global financial economy was speculating on land, and increasingly large firms, hedge funds, and other groups were attempting to buy up large tracts of land in Asia, in Africa, and Latin America, speculating that in the future, the price of that land would go up. So we effectively have the financial economy investing more and more, not in any sense of expanding humanity's productive capacity, but simply attempting to make a quick buck.
You're right that capitalism is always mismeasuring the value of things. And I think you've been illustrating that in many ways up till now. You know, but capitalism's defenders would say, well, look, it's the market and it all kind of comes out and, you know, there's a constant process of refinement and people get more and more information. Capitalists and capitalist traders and financial traders get more and more information about exactly what they're doing and what they're investing in. So what do you make of the argument that capitalism is in a process of getting closer to measuring the underlying value of things better, such that crises like the ones that we've seen recently will become rarer?
Would that it were so, but it would seem that they're not becoming rarer in the least. I mean, what we've seen even in the last 15 years have been this wave after wave of major financial crisis with terrible human impacts. I mean, if we look at the dot-com crisis and the crisis of the Asian tiger economies, if we look at the subprime lending crisis, if we look before that earlier than that at the savings and loan crisis, if we look at the crisis that has recently occurred because of debt in the Eurozone, these are crises that are happening again and again. And I think what we're seeing is not the progressive perfection of markets. We're in fact seeing only the perfection of capital's ability to displace its crisis onto people, onto communities. So for instance, the Eurozone debt crisis, sure, it didn't end up crashing the global economy as it easily could have, but it's being borne at a terrible cost by the people, for instance, of Greece, who are seeing most of their social programs gutted and privatized, who are seeing their healthcare system collapse, who are seeing public safety eviscerated, who are seeing whole university departments be shut down in the name of averting a broader crisis of capitalism. So as long as we only look at the financial economy in an extremely limited way, perhaps there's an argument that there's been an incredible advance in financial technologies. But once we zoom out and look at this on a global level, and when we look at what's happening to communities, I think what we're seeing is only that capitalism is becoming much more advanced at privatizing its crises. I mean, one aspect of this, too, is that the perfection of markets at measuring the real world has really occurred through an incredible technologization and mathematicization of finance. So in the last 40 years, we've seen this incredible development of a new array of highly complicated mathematical formulas for risk management, and the integration of those formulas into incredibly sophisticated trading algorithms, which has led us to the situation that was recently outlined in Michael Lewis's quite popular book, Flash Boys, where, in fact, I mean, according to him, and he's certainly no anti-capitalist critic of the financial sector, the entire financial sector, it seems, is rigged by these large firms and companies which have access to these incredibly powerful computers which can execute trades in a fraction of a second. In fact, by some estimates, somewhere in the range of 60 to 70% of all global financial exchanges are now executed by computers without any human oversight at all. So you can call that an advance in the way that capitalism measures the value of the world, but it is quite a terrifying one, and with, you know, greatly terrifying consequences.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Max Haven teaches art history and critical studies at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax, Canada. His new book is Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power. And he is as well an organizer. He's been involved in student, peace, trade union, anti-racist, and indigenous solidarity struggles over the years. Well, we've talked in some detail about the financialization of the corporate world and of governments that take on debt and engage or enter into partnerships with private firms, and kind of the way they develop metrics for success. What about in the cultural realm? What has financialization, or what has the logic or logics of finance done in the culture arena that concerns you?
I think once we begin to understand financialization in a broader scope, we can begin to see its traces all over the place. I mean, I'm a university teacher and quite involved in the politics of the university. So one of the places I see it most frequently is in the way that students, parents, governments, and university administrators increasingly have come to understand education as a quote-unquote investment. And we hear this sort of nauseating rhetoric all the time, that students shouldn't expect that governments will pay for their education, but instead that they should, you know, take out a loan and leverage that debt, that financialized debt, in order to buy a credential, a university education, which they'll then be able to go on to the job market and sell back to recoup their costs. Of course, this comes at a time when in the United States alone, student loan debt has topped $1 trillion, and when default rates and delinquency rates on student loan debt are skyrocketing. And in fact, many new reports are emerging to indicate that the weight of the student debt on younger generations is fundamentally eroding and undermining their life chances. They're putting off having families, buying homes, becoming economic members of society because of the weight of this debt. And this is, I think, symptomatic of a much deeper shift in our society. As this neoliberal ideology takes hold, we're all encouraged to see ourselves as individual competitive agents rather than any form of collectivity. We're no longer encouraged to see ourselves as citizens who care for one another, let alone something more that I would like to see, which is as commoners, as people who are fundamentally dependent on one another, who create common forms of wealth and common forms of community care. All of that's pushed aside in favor of this idea that we should all sort of see ourselves as miniature Donald Trump. And of course, Donald Trump is an excellent example of precisely how this sort of ideology enters into the mainstream and popular culture. The popular show The Apprentice, which has been on, you know, for many years and was really organized around his persona, really attempts to show us what the exalted neoliberal financialized subject looks like. One who has no compulsion about betraying one's friends and allies. One who ruthlessly competes to outperform one's peers. This is the image that's held up to all of us now. And so another example, for instance, is the incredible popularity of home renovation television, reality television shows, where the idea is you're going to go out and buy a home not because you have a commitment to community, not because you want a roof over your head, but because you want to use it as a financial asset that you can leverage for greater gain in the future. And this idea has really seeped out and saturated throughout all of society, so that increasingly we're talking about everything as investments. There are a plethora now of relationship advice books, which advise the reader to understand themselves not as a lover or a friend or a companion, but as an investor in relationships. There's advice books that encourage parents to educate their children as savvy financial investors, to see the family as a corporation that needs to be managed as you would manage Goldman Sachs. This is extremely dangerous, and it's dangerous not only in the sense that it normalizes the neoliberal paradigm of individualistic competition, but it also valorizes really the worst elements of our human nature, in a sense, and it fundamentally privatizes our sense of the future. So if we can no longer rely on one another to provide for our futures, then it all just becomes the competitive work of the individual. For instance, as we allow pensions and old age security to increasingly be privatized and downloaded onto the individual, we become increasingly adept at attempting to get as much as we can for ourselves. And of course, the irony here is that the more and more that we invest in privatized savings, the more and more we invest in the United States in, for instance, 401k plans, or in other countries in highly privatized forms of retirement savings, those funds are actually being used and leveraged by major investment banks and others in order to undermine the economy that we live in. It is precisely those sorts of funds that are investing in private equity firms, in hedge funds, in major investment banks, which are doing the neoliberal and financialized works of dismantling the economy as we know it.
You were talking, Max, right there about people's sense of the future. And if we go to the title of your new book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, does this sense of the future and the way it's affected by financial logic that, as you argue, is seeping into our social and cultural lives, is that related to imagination and to the crises of imagination that you are highlighting in this book?
Yes, very much so. You know, when I began the research, which has gone into this book and also another book, a more academic book on the cultures of financialization, which will be coming out later this summer, I began by trying to understand the power of imaginary wealth. Because to a very real extent, what the financial sector is producing and what disappears and reappears with such terrifying alacrity is utterly imaginary. What is a credit default swap or a derivative contract or what a hedge fund does other than the manipulation of imaginary assets? But of course, once you begin to ask the question about imaginary wealth, you fall down a bit of a rabbit hole, because what sort of wealth isn't imaginary? We can talk about the value of the things that we need. We can talk about the value of the sunlight, of food, of relationships, of water, of those basic necessities in our lives. But it becomes very slippery. And as we transform those things into quantified measurements, when we try and ascribe a price to them, we begin to see that the entire economy, the entire capitalist economy, is based on a certain set of fictions about what and who is valuable. And this is what fascinates me, is that once we begin to look hard at finance and financialization, we realize that there's a lot more imagination going on at the root of our economic system than we care to imagine. Of course, if you go and speak to the people on Wall Street or the defenders of the financial sector, they'll tell you that this is just as real a manipulation of wealth as, you know, when you go and buy a chocolate bar at the corner store. Or really, they'll link it back to this primordial moment that they imagine, where two farmers are exchanging eggs for wheat in a barter situation. There's this sense that within the preferred imagining of the financial sector, all of this speculative action is just a logical extension of the most basic economic activities of humankind. But of course, that's not the case. A derivatives contract, a collateralized debt obligation, is on the one hand an incredibly artificial way of valuing human time and labor. It is a way of trying to understand the world. A very, very skewed one, though. What exactly does it refer to? What exactly is the underlying asset to which it's supposed to speak? This, for me, implies the incredible amount of imaginative work at play in the financial economy. And of course, we see that on the world's Wall Streets, where they're constantly imagining new, more innovative, more cunning ways of programming machines, of developing trading algorithms, of commodifying new aspects of life. But this is also happening on a very everyday basis. I mean, just take the way that people imagine their homes, for instance. Most of us, of course, imagine our home as precisely what it is. It's a physical structure in which we live, but also in a broader, more cultural sense, that we have a sense of pride in where we live, maybe, or we have a sense that it is part of a community. We have emotional attachments to our homes. There's an imaginative way in which all of the physical and material aspects of our economy live. There's a cultural element to it. But that cultural and imaginative element is increasingly, I think, subordinated to the financial imaginary, in the sense that we are increasingly encouraged to see housing not as a place of community, not as a place of family, not as a place of pride and a place of identity. We're increasingly encouraged to see homes as merely one speculative asset which we buy now and sell later. Or we're encouraged to see ourselves as renters, again, as sort of investors, maybe abject investors, but still investors who are making certain savvy economic choices for future payoff. This is increasingly how we're encouraged to see all the aspects of our lives. I mean, I think economies are imaginative systems, essentially. They are ways that we come to understand, think about, and relate the value of things. Economies are means by which we come to understand and think about how we cooperate as fundamentally cooperative beings. Finance offers us one way of imagining that connectivity, but it is a fundamentally perverse way because it is fundamentally individualistic, it's fundamentally speculative, and it's fundamentally capitalist in its logic.
And just to read a couple of passages from my guest Max Haven's new book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, that really buttresses what you just said. You write that because value is ultimately imaginary, money is never a perfect reflection or representation of value. It always mismeasures the real value of our cooperation. And you also write that under capitalism, value is abstracted and alienated, and finance redoubles or, quote, squares this abstraction. Well, Max, you were speaking earlier about the way in which financialization in the social sphere is encouraging individuals, encouraging people like you and me to think of ourselves as sort of individual, you know, risk managers and investors, whether it be education or whether it be traditional forms of market investing, to really be thinking about the bottom line, to be thinking in terms of monetary metrics, to which I say, and a lot of people say, you know, we're forced to be in this position. We are all in debt. We're in student debt. We're in consumer debt. And so obviously we have to think about the bottom line. And the powers that be tell us we are in debt because we have overspent. We have spent beyond our means. We haven't been prudent with the way we manage our money, our bank accounts, our savings. What's your response to that?
This is, I think, the great myth of our age, that debt is an individual responsibility and we must pay, that we must sacrifice practically everything in our lives to this new deity who demands that, you know, we have sinned and now we must repent. It's an incredible amount of power that debt has over our lives, and it militates against understanding debt sociologically. And when we do that, we realize that, in fact, the massive, massive growth of both personal debt and government debts is the direct corollary to the rise of financialization and neoliberalism. So as neoliberalism and financialization have really torn apart the social welfare state, have, you know, gutted and abolished forms of social care that we once enjoyed, we've been forced to increasingly buy these back as commodities through debt. So, for instance, as governments have withdrawn funding to post-secondary education, we've increasingly been forced to take out loans to pay for the education we need to be full and active participants in the capitalist economy. You know, in the United States, you never had socialized healthcare, which is a great shame. But this, again, is another way in which something that should have been provided collectively is downloaded onto the individual. And then the debts that accrue from those costs become a means of disciplining us as individuals and as communities. Similarly, over the last 40 years, we've seen a massive privatization of housing, in the sense that increasingly we've been encouraged to invest in buying a home and using it as a means of a store of wealth and a means of upward mobility. But in fact, what we've seen coming out of that is an incredible amount of mortgage debt and an incredible inflation of the price of shelter itself. And beyond that, we've seen, because the economy has become more and more financialized, because there's more and more speculative wealth floating around, we've seen massive inflation in the costs of basic staples, whether it's oil, petroleum products, including plastics, out of which most things are made now, whether it's food prices, whether it's the price of transportation. All of these prices have increased, and increasingly more and more people are going into deeper forms of odious consumer debt just to pay for the necessities of life. So it's easy, if we view ourselves simply as individuals, to say, oh, we've done bad. We've maybe bought this electronic product, you know, that we should not have bought, this iPad that, you know, was beyond our means. And now we need to castigate ourselves and blame ourselves for going into debt. But really what we've seen is a number of trends going on at the same time. And they sort of map out on graphs if you look at them, which is the rate of consumer debt increases and increases and increases, especially for the poorest sections of society. Meanwhile, corporate profits are skyrocketing. Meanwhile, financial profits are skyrocketing. And those are not disconnected from one another. Effectively, what this debt and financial system has meant is a massive transfer of wealth from society's poorer segments to the rich.
Max Haven, in a section of your new book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, you discuss how the financial sector helps capitalists as a group. And maybe the way to get into this argument is to take up the message we often get that capitalism is rooted in competition, that the competition between capitalist actors is absolutely key. Is that how you see it?
This is one of the most important lessons I've learned from reading the work of Karl Marx and various subsequent authors who have been inspired by Marx. Marx was very canny in his understanding that capitalism is not driven by some ironclad logic, but by a whole series of internal contradictions. And one of the most interesting contradictions is that capitalists, yes, they must compete with one another in order to drive the capitalist economy. It is a system that is inherently driven by competition between capitalist actors. Yes, they must compete, but they must also find ways of cooperating. They have to find ways of defending their interests as a class. And for instance, you can see this in a sort of vulgar way in their support for super PAC lobby groups in the United States, for instance. You know, many different corporations and corporate interests will pool money and give it to lobby groups and to think tanks who articulate their interests together. And you can also see it in forms of intercapitalist collusion. For instance, out there on the west coast of the United States, you had a collusion that's now in the courts between firms like Google and Apple, where they basically conspired to not try and recruit engineers from one another's firms so that those engineers could not demand higher wages. Occasionally, capitalist cooperation takes these more apparent and visible forms. But also, it's useful to think of the financial sector as a means by which capitalists cooperate. This is a sector where capitalists who've generated surplus value from their exploitation of workers, say a mine owner over here, a factory owner over there, someone who owns plantations over here, they all put their ill-begotten wealth together in a bank. And the bank then lends out that money to other capitalists, say a capitalist who wants to build a canal or a railway, or a capitalist who wants to build an undersea telegraph cable, if we're thinking about the 19th century here. In this way, all of those capitalists who might have been competing are now collaborating in a way, but collaborating without the sort of direct collusion that we might imagine. And this is really the structural function of the financial sector. It allows for capitalism to expand, to encroach onto new areas of life, to privatize and enclose new spheres of social cooperation by pooling the ill-begotten assets of many capitalists. Now, this, I think, is a more nuanced and interesting approach to how capitalists cooperate than some of the sort of conspiracy theories that we've been entertained with over the last few years since the financial collapse, whether those conspiracy theories have to do with the role of the Federal Reserve or various more or less racist ideas about a global Illuminati. Capitalists don't need those forms of conspiracy. They don't all need to get together in the basement of the Federal Reserve building and conspire to steal from the public and enclose the commons. They have structural means of doing so. But that also, and this is, I think, where it's even more important, that also inevitably leads to crises. And the crisis basically looks like this. As more and more capitalists invest their ill-begotten surplus value in the financial sector becomes more and more and more profitable. As different groups of national capitalists, say the Japanese capitalists, the American capitalists, the Chinese capitalists, now the French capitalists, as they invest in their own local markets and their own banking and financial sectors, those sectors come into international competition. So we begin to see fractures within the financial system as different national blocks, as different groups of capitalists start to fight against one another. More generally than that, still, too, it's very easy for the financial sector to become way more profitable than any other form of capitalist exploitation. And this is very clear today when, in fact, you know, if you give someone the option of investing in a new factory in, say, Detroit, or the option of investing in a hedge fund, which is actively liquidating what few factories still exist in Detroit, by and large, the far more safe bet is to invest with a hedge fund. The hedge fund provides a much safer and more secure return on investment. So why would you, if you were a capitalist who had a lot of money to invest in a new factory? Why wouldn't you simply invest in the financial sector, where profits, even today after the 2008 crisis, are far higher than almost any other sector of the economy? And this begins this sort of crisis of capitalist accumulation that has to do with the financial sector, where increasingly there's less and less money for the investment in actual capitalist accumulation. And you get more and more investment in speculative returns. And this leads to all sorts of crises and international conflicts.
Going back to your analysis of what people sense about their future, what people's imagination is at the current historical moment as we live in a financialized society, as we think of ourselves as enclosed by debts and other obligations, as we are encouraged to, and I'm reading from your book, encouraged to understand the future and act in the present based on the short-term calculation of risk and the individual maximization of monetary benefit. So what's the alternative? How would you like the imagination, the social imagination, our individual imaginations to change? How can we, how should we liberate it, and what could it look like?
I think it begins from the recognition that, again, Marx had all those years ago, which is that each of us carries our bond with the rest of society in our pocket every day. That's money. In money, of which finance is the sort of expansion or explosion, in money we have a representation of our cooperative collective power. What is money except this manifestation of capitalism? And what is capitalism except a sort of nightmare version of what we as human beings, as communities, as workers might be capable of, were it not for the fact that every day we had to go to work and be exploited? For Marx, money is the ultimate commodity. It's the flagship of the commodity. And the commodity, you know, whether it is a loaf of bread, whether it's a car, is the solidification of our cooperative energies. So I think the answer to a world beyond financialization is to remember that everything we are and everything we have is in fact the residue of our stolen cooperation sold back to us. The answer then, I think, is we need to reimagine and rekindle the commons. And the commons, just to return to history, are these shared lands and resources that peasants held in common in medieval Europe, which were enclosed by the elites at the birth of capitalism. And at that time, land was turned into a commodity. People's labor was turned into a commodity that needed to be bought and sold. But we still have a memory of the commons, and those things that we share in our lives, whether they be our networks of friendship, whether they be things like community gardens, whether they be those common elements of our lives that have been sort of enclosed by the state, like social welfare programs, these still are what make life worth living and give us the vital life support systems. I think the antidote to financialization is to reclaim those commons, to reclaim the things that allow us to survive and thrive and enjoy abundance together. Now, as I say that, I would also say that we're seeing a very interesting financialization of the commons today, which is a very worrisome trend. And often it goes under the name of the sharing economy, where we're encouraged increasingly to sort of hand over our capacity to cooperate, to share, to build commons to these intermediary companies like, say, Airbnb or car share firms, or firms that want us to sort of commodify our community gardening experience. We're seeing a wholesale privatization and commodification of the commons in the service sector, where our ability to care for elderly people, for the disabled, for children, where our ability to grow and feed one another, to provide childcare, all these things are being offered as services, when in fact they should be something that we build and maintain in common. So we've seen a sort of financialization of the commons, but even beyond that, I think there is still a great amount of potential in the idea of the commons as a sort of north star to guide our navigation. We don't want to simply return to the older forms of capitalism we had before. Sure, for many people, Keynesianism, as it existed in the from the 1960s and the 1970s, was qualitatively better for many people. It provided much more for the working class than our present form of financialized neoliberal capitalism. But it was also terrible for many people, and it relied on a global system of exploitation. So our politics, I think, and our imagination can't be limited to a return to a moment of capitalism that we imagine existed before now. Instead, we need to, I think, rededicate ourselves to moving beyond individualism and this idea that we're all competitive agents by actively building grassroots common efforts in the here and now, but also refusing to let those be commodified and refusing to let that and, you know, merely our own lives be the horizon of politics. We have a world to win, and I think it demands to be won, because unfortunately the financialized system that we have today is destroying the planet. We know this. We know that it's attempting to transform even the future of the planet itself into a commodity in terms of carbon credits and the idea of carbon trading schemes. I find this incredibly perverse, that the only way we can imagine our ecological future is in commodified terms and financialized terms. And that's really what's at stake.
And what I like about your analysis is that rekindling the radical imagination or bringing it to the fore is all about doing. It's not just about thinking and perceiving, although that's a big part of it, but it's about doing and putting things into practice to change the world.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, and lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And I hope this show has helped fuel your radical imagination about the better world that our hearts know is possible. The rich will come down.